Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guests today are Matt McFarland and Amanda Hahn. They are owners of Keystone CPA in Orange County, voted one of the top 100 CPA firms. We have had the privilege of speaking with them in front of probably at least, four or five audiences. To be honest with you, I've always learned something from them. They have an expertise in real estate. They've been in their own business now for 7 years. And actually, it's a real pleasure to be able to speak with you guys today. You've saved me money. I've learned something every time I've heard you, which is kind of cool. So we welcome you to our show. Now, you guys are married. So what's with these?
We are.
And you have, you started a family and everything. So that's fantastic. And do you get any tax breaks if you have a kid? Is she earning money yet? I'm only kidding.
You can. I mean, we joke, but I mean, obviously, you can. You know, you get to claim your dependents. There's child tax credits that are available. You know, obviously, they like to take these things away from you the more money you make. But yeah, no, it's one of the strategies we talk about. Well, you know, maybe not necessarily with a 2-year-old, but people that have kids who can do something in their business. You know, why not hire your children to work in your business and give them money, you know, because the money you can pay them can be a tax deduction in your business. And then the other cool thing is that, you know, if the kid's 8 or 10 years old, you know, they can set up a Roth IRA. And imagine what a Roth IRA can do for 60 or 70 years of tax-free compounded growth, you know.
Well, let's talk a little bit about a Roth. We had ended the other segment with contributing to retirement accounts. And if you were going to contribute directly to a Roth, what would be the amount you could do, and then what are the rules about converting your existing retirement account to a Roth?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, what you can contribute to a Roth is $5,500 a year or $6,500 a year if you're 50 or older. You have up until April 15th of this year to contribute for last year. Now, you know, as we alluded to, you know. Typically, you're not going to get a deduction when you put money into a Roth because the benefit of it, the money that grows in the Roth, it's all tax-free. So you're not going to get a double dip. You don't get a deduction on the front end and tax-free growth on the back end, obviously. But it's a pretty powerful strategy just for the tax-free growth aspect of it.
And if it's for someone who has a 401k, you know, as of a few years ago, now there's a Roth 401k component, which is great because within a 401k account, you can put up to $17,500 in the employee bucket of a Roth 401k. And that the rules are the same. The $17,500 goes into the Roth bucket. You don't get a deduction, but that grows tax-free permanently as well.
Okay, that's pretty good. Now, what if you have, I mean, I don't know if it's still allowed, but at one time they allowed you to convert your whole retirement account. I'm not an expert at this, but let's say I had a pretty good size IRA. I could say, okay, I want it to be a Roth IRA. I'm going to go ahead and transfer $400,000 over there and take a one-time tax hit. Am I stating that incorrectly or correctly? And is that still available?
Yes, that is correct. And yes, that is still available. It's one of those loopholes of how you get a large amount of money into the Roth IRA. So every year you are able to convert as much money as you wish from a traditional retirement account into a Roth IRA. The downside, of course, you know, based on the date you're making that conversion, the fair market value of that account, it becomes taxable income on your tax return for that year.
Right.
But what I love about the Roth conversion concept is that the IRS actually gives you a risk-free trial to do that. What I mean by that is, let's say today, you know, Bruce, you said, hey, I've got some, you know, money in my IRA. I've got some great deals, and I want to put the money into. I know it's going to have exponentially large returns. So I'm going to go ahead and convert $100,000 into the Roth account. You know, by this time next year, let's say we're doing your tax return, and we look at the investment and said, oh, no, Bruce actually made a wrong investment decision, the value of that account has actually gone down. It's now less than $100,000. We didn't make the amount of money we wanted to. We lost some money.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can always do is before the return is filed, you can always just undo that Roth conversion. So it's just filing paperwork with the retirement custodian, and you move the money. You retitle the asset back from the Roth bucket into the traditional retirement bucket, and that's it. You don't have to pay taxes on that money at all. It's as if it never happened.
Okay. That's another thing I didn't know. What about real estate?
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out, Bruce, that anybody can convert to a Roth IRA now, regardless of their income level. So I think that's what you were alluding to earlier. Before 2010, there was actually an income limit on who could actually convert to a Roth IRA.
That's what it was.
Yeah, there's still an income limit on who can contribute to a Roth, but anybody can convert to a Roth IRA now, regardless of their income level. So it opens up a lot more opportunities for people that maybe, wanted to get more on their Roth IRA, but, weren't happy with the $5,500 a year or whatever it was, you know.
Right. Okay. There was an income limitation that you couldn't even do it without the earning less than that, correct? Okay.
Yes, correct.
Okay. A lot of people that we have as clients, they have a lot of rentals, and so they're depreciating away, and a lot of these guys are going to be reselling the properties at some point. So is the amount of profit, let's just say they flat out take a profit. They don't do a 1031 exchange. It's a rental that they've held for over 2 years. Is there a recapture tax on the depreciation, and is it taxed differently than capital gains?
Yeah, that's a good question. There is a recapture tax. The gain that's associated with the depreciation that you took, that's going to be taxed at 25%. So it's slightly higher than the normal long-term capital gains rate of 15% or 20% if you're in those higher income ranges that we talked about earlier. So it is slightly higher than that. Now, any gain that's outside of the depreciation, you'd apply your regular capital gains tax rates, whether it's a 15 or 20%. So, yeah, a chunk of it's probably going to be taxed at 25% for federal, and then, a chunk would be 15 or 20%. And then, you throw on your state, whatever, if it's California or another state, you're going to have your whatever your rate is for the state, too.
Okay. Some of the people in our business have offices at their home. So they're doing their, depreciation might not be the right word. They're doing their deduction for having a home office, okay? Mm-hmm. Now they sell the residence. And here's a good question, and I don't know the answer to. I sell my residence, and I have that first $250,000. Let's say I own it separately, just one owner. And my first $250,000 is tax-free, both federal and state. However, I wrote off 20% of the residence for the last 5 years as office. Do I have a recapture on that? Have I created a profit?
I guess it depends on what you mean by writing off. So what I mean by that is if you claim depreciation on your house and you wrote off, you depreciated a portion of your house, when you go and sell it, you will have to pay tax on that depreciation portion. That can't be excluded due to the $250,000 rule per se.
Okay.
But any deductions you took for a percentage of your mortgage interest, your utilities, your insurance, your association dues, your repairs, anything else, any other deduction typically taken on a home office, that never gets recaptured. So that's going to be probably a bigger chunk of what you took as a deduction anyway.
Okay. So it's still a good idea to take.
Yeah, there might be a little depreciation recapture, but it's probably not, quote-unquote, significant, I guess, is what I'm...
Okay.
Easy way to look at it.
Yeah, and I think the other key thing to realize, I talk to a lot of investors a lot of times, and they're very scared of this term recapture. It's almost like a bad word. But I think what a lot of times people forget is that when we say recapture, the term is called recapture because you've already gotten a tax deduction anyway, right? So in your example, we've been depreciating it for 5 years. That means we've gotten the money back from the IRS for this depreciation already, and now all we're doing is we're paying that back.
Right.
So there was still the time value of money from the savings for those five-year period.
Okay. The rule that says you can make $250,000 or $500,000 on the sale of a residence, what is the time frame rules on that? Is it two of the last 5 years that you've had to live in that property?
Yeah, you had to have used it and owned it for at least two out of the last 5 years. So it doesn't have to be, you know, consecutive 2 years. You could have, you know, quote unquote, used it the first year and then used it last year or whatever. But yeah, it's a two out of the past five year test for you to be able to, you know, take advantage of that opportunity.
And I'm just playing. You and I both know that whenever we have an audience, somebody sits in the back and thinks of every tricky question they can. Remember that we had that one table where every tricky question came from the same table. I had to laugh at that.
Yeah, I think they were passing notes around.
That was pretty fun. So now I'm in that seat. So let's say I lived in a property for 2 years and I haven't lived in it for almost three. I sell the property. When can I, but I've lived in another residence for 3 years. Has the clock for my 2 years started ticking for the second place, or do I now have to stay there 2 years anew? How does that work?
Yeah, it's, break it down. So you're, in the first part of the example, you've lived in a house for two, moved out, you still own it for the next three, and then you're selling it. That one you can still claim the exclusion on, even though you haven't lived there for the past 3 years under that 2 of 5 test. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
On your second residence, yeah, the clock starts when you move in. But one thing to keep in mind is that you can only use this exclusion, this 250, 500 exclusion, once every 2 years.
Okay.
Unless there's unforeseen circumstances that happen on your, let's say, your second house. You know, maybe you change of employment or, you know, I don't know, you have to move, there's a death in the family or something like that. But in the general sense of the term, yeah, you get to use it once every 2 years. So you might want to, in those situations, it's good for somebody to kind of sit down with their advisor and kind of plan, you know, strategically, proactively to figure out, you know, what's going to work best in their financial situation.
And this is a valid strategy. We have clients that actually do this, you know. I mean, I can't imagine that because I hate moving. But we have clients, you know, with three or four kids. And what they do is, you know, from time to time, they'll move into a house, rehab it while they're living there with the kids, and then move every few years just to get the tax-free gain the tax-free income and also just get the gain from the sale of the house.
Well, when you start looking at how much that could add up doing four moves, it's a lot. So you could understand that it might be worth some inconvenience to make $2 million that isn't taxable. The first time I heard this law, I actually called a friend who's passed on at this point, but Robert Bruss was just the smartest guy that I knew. He was an attorney and a lawyer. And when I read this, I went, that can't be true. So I already knew it wasn't true. I called him up. I said, I probably misread this, but this is what my conclusion is. He says, yeah, that's exactly right. I said, you've got to be kidding me. How did they get this passed? Because I'm thinking, how many states could you possibly make $500,000 on a house in, period?
Right.
So, you know, there's probably five states that benefited, and yet it's a national law. I don't know. I just thought, unbelievable. And yet I've never taken
it. Go
ahead.
I was going to say, we did see this a lot in, you know, the early 2000s when the real estate market was starting to kind of take off, as you know. And then, you know, like Amanda said, you're kind of seeing it a little bit more where we've got a couple clients who are taking advantage of it. And, you know, obviously, depending on the market, more people might take advantage of it.
One final question in this regards, and this is, let's say somebody is using a residence and they're at a year and a half and they actually have to do something, that forced move for a job. Do they get 75% of the deduction, or do the IRS say, we'll just say you stayed there 2 years?
Well, you know, it's that you're right. It's the exclusion is prorated based on the time you were there, compared to the 2 year period. So in your example, yeah, it'd be, you get 75% of 250 or 75% of 500 would be your exclusion.
Okay. So, that makes sense.
And we've helped clients save money on that before where, you know, sometimes real estate agents, maybe they've been in the business for 20 plus years and they're thinking of an old law. And I saw this happen, and, you know, because the law changed in 97. And we had a client that was, you know, they told him, well, go ahead and sell your place. They've been there a year and a half. And I said, well, you know, you guys are going to pay tax on there. And so they ended up actually holding their property for, you know, enough more months to get that 2 year period. And it worked out for them. So, you know, because in their situation, they didn't have a job change. It was just they were moving. So it is important to note, but
They just thought if they bought a more expensive house, that would all be tax deferred type
thing? Yeah, they thought of the old rule. Yeah, they just kind of rolled. They're going to buy another one a little more expensive, and everybody's good. Nobody's going to pay taxes. But, you know, that's kind of where the law changed a little bit.
Yeah. What about using a credit line on a residence where you got a house free and clear? You say, okay, well, let's get it appraised to get a $500,000 credit line, and you start using that to do investments. Is all of that deductible, all the interest deductible on that?
Like a lot of things, it depends. Most of the time, you're going to deduct that interest against your rental income. So, in the sense that, is the interest offsetting your rental income? Yes. There might be a way for you to deduct some of that interest on, you know, part of your, against your primary residence, like on part of your itemized deduction. So, there's a lot of opportunities that you should be able to deduct a lot of that interest. It's just a matter of
where,
you know, kind of where and when, I guess.
Is there a maximum amount as far as that goes for the IRS? As far as on a credit line, or is it an amount more than you paid for your property? I'm just, again, these are like hearsay things I hear in my paths.
Right. Well, if you're going to deduct it against a primary residence, generally the amount of interest, it's going to be interest on up to $100,000. So in your example, you use 500, you know, 100,000, you know, on the interest on the first 100, you could just deduct against, you know, your W-2, you know, part of your itemized deductions. The other interest on the other 400, you'd probably deduct it against your rental income. And then it's just a matter of, you know, one of the things we're talking about earlier is, does your rental properties end up with a net profit? They end up with a net loss, you know?
Yeah.
But
there's no limit on how much interest expense is deducted against rental income. That 100,000 limitation is only for HELOCs on primary homes.
Okay. I always get asked this question, you know, because we flip properties and they go, well, how do you save taxes flipping properties? And I'll be darned if I've found a way. So is there some magic if I buy a house with the intent to resell it for a profit and I hold it for 3 or 4 months, is there any magic that you guys know how to avoid paying taxes on that?
I mean, there's a couple different things. I think the one of the main ones that we typically look at with fix and flip clients is really using entity structuring.
Okay.
And that's a strategy to help minimize self-employment taxes because fix and flip income is considered ordinary income. So not only are we paying federal income taxes and state income taxes, but we also are paying upwards of 15% in self-employment tax. So typically we look at structuring, you know, maybe a S corporation, for example, where we can play between salaries taken from the owners versus distributions to the owners to try to minimize or maybe cut the payroll taxes in half. So that's one strategy. Another one that's common is, you know, kind of a recurring one we were talking about earlier is with respect to retirement accounts. Because fix and flip income is active income, now that opens up the door for us to look at setting up different types of retirement accounts to reduce the taxable income that we're paying taxes on. And on that note, I kind of wanted to bring it back. I recall maybe earlier I might have said that the simple IRA was still available to be set up for last year. If I did, that was actually incorrect. The deadline for that has passed. But we can still set up a SEP IRA. So if there's anyone, you know, fix and flippers who are looking at a large profit but didn't do any planning for last year, it is still possible to set up a SEP IRA as one of the ways to reduce their taxes. On the entity side, you know, it kind of depends on the person, but if they didn't already have an entity set up, then it's probably too late to use the S Corp strategy at this point for last year.
How often does the IRS look at somebody's buy and sell property and it's not in an entity and they say, well, gosh, we think you're a dealer? Does that designation happen to very many people?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I can say that for us, keep our fingers crossed, we've never had anyone be audited for that issue as of today.
I was, just so you know.
Oh, no. Did you want to share your experience?
Years and years ago, when I used to do my own taxes, I really did. I got audited, and I had probably done, I don't know, 30 or 40 flips that year, filled out the proper paperwork, and the IRS guy goes, "Man, you do a lot of this stuff." He said, "You must be a dealer." And I thought it was a compliment. I said, "Yeah." That's the day I learned, oh, you don't do an audit by yourself, or your taxes for that matter. And how it came up, it was I had bought a condo for a very little bit of money, and it was a sort of a pain as a rental. So I sold it and carried a note. And because I was declared a dealer in that tax return, they went back and said, "Well, on that note, we consider that you received all cash," even though I didn't receive a dime. So I had a taxable gain of $45,000 on a condo that cost me $15,000 that I never received a dime down payment. That was a rude awakening.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a good point you make. It's in terms of 99.9% of the time, we don't recommend that clients represent themselves if they do get audited. Because it's funny that the technical rule and that whole dealer versus non-dealer, it's a property by property designation. So it's not, a lot of times they're just going to say, in general, you're a dealer, we're going to apply this rule to every property you sold. That's not necessarily the case. So somebody might find themselves where, the market is turning up, as we've seen the last couple of years. Maybe you happen to buy a property with your intention to hold it for a couple of years, but you just got an offer you couldn't refuse, and you only held it for 8 months. Well, does that mean you were a dealer of that property? No. But, obviously, if you're representing yourself and you don't necessarily know how to kind of work around the intricacies of the law, you might just, find yourself in that bucket. So
yeah, and it kind of infects your other files, and you may not be knowledgeable enough to go, no, this is not a dot a dealer flip.
Right, exactly.
And, one other thing that happens to people in our business is that they repair rental property. So they buy it in 2013, and it needs a paint and carpet, but it also needs an air conditioning unit and needs a roof. What part of that can they deduct fully as they repair it, and what items have to be more of a depreciated deduction?
Yeah, this is a good question too, and this is one where you definitely want, people want to sit down with their advisor and kind of work, ahead of time, if you will, because this is this would be more of the gray area, if you will, because the IRS is going to look at this as, well, you bought the property and all the stuff you had to do, they're going to try and say that it's all going to be capitalized and, you got to depreciate it over time. Where in reality, there should be things that you should be able to deduct right away if it's stuff that you're fixing. But it's really important on the buy side that you're really documenting everything, because they are going to try and say that it's capitalized. Everything should be capitalized if you're, putting it in for the intention of getting it ready for rent. Now, that's different than if you've held the property, somebody moves out, and you're getting it rent ready again. That's more kind of the repair angle that is kind of tried and true. But there is opportunity there. It's just, again, it's a matter of planning ahead and sitting down and going through your situation, because you don't want to find yourself just, by default doing something one way when you can. There's opportunity for others.
We only have a little over a minute left. I wanted to get to short sales. Short sales, California in 2013, did that ever get resolved as far as, what the subject I'm talking about, where you get debt forgiveness taxable? So did the California and the IRS line up for 2013, or is it still different?
Well, there's a couple of things. It's kind of different. So the IRS in 2013 still allowed homeowners to not pay taxes on any cancellation of debt income up to about $2 million worth of, debt, if you will.
That ought to
California,
work.
That actually went away at the end of 2012. So there's kind of there was a 1 year it was IRS only. And, actually now in 2014, that opportunity for the IRS is no longer available. Now, they may bring it back, obviously, but it kind of just remains to be seen.
Right. It started 2013 out the same way, right? And then they kind of retroactively said we're going to be okay with it again.
Yeah, I think they extended it. I think it originally was supposed to, for the IRS, it was supposed to expire at the end of 12, and then they retroactively put it back in place for one more year.
Right.
Yeah.
Guys, we're out of time. Thank you so much for taking an hour out of a very busy schedule. KeystoneCPA.com, and give Matt and Amanda a call.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.